So we're continuing our look at the Dharma through symbols and stories. So we're looking at the Dharma through symbols and stories. And we've looked at symbols and stories to do with the problem, if you like, our existential situation. We've looked at symbols and stories to do with the solution, if you like, enlightenment. And we're currently looking at symbols and stories to do with how we get from one to the other, the path, if you like, although that's a bit of a symbol in its own right. So we're looking at what joins, you know, how we get from the problem to the solution. And last week, we introduced sort of three models. We said, well, okay, well, what did we say? We said there's, if you like, we just have to accept that we're here. A. This is a really high-tech piece of visual aid. This is us. We're at A. And presumably we're not totally satisfied with A, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And this, if you like, is B, it's enlightenment. And somehow we've got to get from A to B. We either got to get from A to B, or we've got to allow B to take over A, or we've got to break through from A to B, something. Somehow A is going to become B. And we saw that there are three big models, three overall models for how this happens, which are the model of self-development, the model of self-surrender, and the model of self-discovery, or I'm going to call it self-realization, maybe, because I think that's probably better. Model of self-realization. So in self-development, we sort of work on ourselves to become, to move from A to B, to develop more of the qualities of A and to leave behind some of the sort of things that keep us at B. We work on ourselves by a process of effort. We do it ourselves. We develop ourselves. That's self-development. Self-surrender, if you like, A sort of allows B to take it over. We just sort of give ourselves up to B. We cease to be A and just become B, allow it to take us over. And then in self-realization, we have the idea that, well, perhaps we've got sort of Buddha nature within us. Perhaps the spiritual life isn't about making ourselves a particular way by developing ourselves. Perhaps it's not about allowing something outside us to sort of take us over, surrendering to something outside us. Perhaps it's about allowing something within us to unfold. Perhaps it's about allowing our Buddha nature to unfold. So perhaps it's self-realization rather than either self-development or self-discovery or self-realization. So, I mean, people get... We saw that... Well, I said that I owe these to Subhuti, who is the only person I know who sort of talked in this terms. But it seems to make an awful lot of sense out of almost some of the conflicts you can get in different spiritual paths, where people get very... people can get quite sort of fundamentalist about one of them or another. They say, no, it's all about self-development. It's all about developing yourself and moving from A to B and using karma to develop yourself. And anything else is rubbish. Or other people will say, no, you've just got to allow it to emerge. And that's the only way to do it. And if you do it any other way, you're wrong. And we sort of saw last week that we looked at a story that brings them all in. So we saw last week that really we need them all. Each is a sort of partial model of the way we grow and develop. And what we're going to do this week is look at self-development, which is, in a way, the most basic, the most commonsensical, the most obvious. So we're going to describe that, but then we're going to ask, well, why would we need anything else? Why would we need anything else? And we're going to do that in the context of a sort of bigger story of how, a sort of overarching story, which is the story of, if you like, the hero's quest. So, first of all, what do we mean by self-development? It's probably pretty obvious. I mean, most of us are sort of familiar with the idea of self-development, perhaps from work or from all sorts of situations. It's a pretty familiar idea, and it's usually the way we present the spiritual path. It's the way we present Buddhism at beginners' classes. It's the way we generally practice. It's the idea that sort of underlies most of what we do. And the main feature is that we make an effort to change. So we make an effort to change. So we need to be clear about what that means. It's not that we sort of will ourselves to be different. Right, I'm going to hold my breath till I'm blue in the face unless I get more compassionate. You know, we can't sort of will ourselves to be more compassionate. So it's not like we will ourselves to change. But we take on practices that will gradually change us. Or we put ourselves in situations that will gradually change us. We make the effort to take on practices and put ourselves in situations that will gradually change us in a positive direction. So definitely not that we will ourselves to be different, but we set up circumstances that will allow us to become different. So we take on the practice of ethics. We practice the precepts, and this gradually develops habits of kindness, generosity, simplicity, honesty, awareness. We take on the practice of meditation. We gradually learn how to work on our mind. We gradually experience more and more positive mental states, higher mental states, see things more clearly. We study and we reflect and we meditate on the Dharma so that we sort of clarify our vision of the world, leave behind our sort of conditioned way of seeing the world and see reality a bit more clearly. So we take on those practices. We take on those practices and they gradually change us. And then we put ourselves in situations that change us. We go on retreat where it's easy to meditate, where we talk to a lot of other Buddhists, hear the Dharma. We spend time with other Buddhists. We develop friendships with other Buddhists. We open ourselves to the influence of the Sangha. So we make an effort to do all those things. We do it. We make an effort to do all those things and they gradually catalyze changes in us. So what we're doing is we're using the law of karma, or the law of conditionality, if you like. So I mean, this depends on the fact, it's sort of really fundamental to Buddhism, that all things, everything that we call a thing, well, we're all processes. We are processes, everything is a process. And we processes change due to causes and conditions. They're conditioned by other things around them. So the way we act, the way we think, the way we speak, the circumstances we're in, they're constantly affecting us. They're constantly sort of affecting us, changing us, if you like. So by choosing the way we act, the way we speak, and the way we think, by choosing the circumstances we're in, we're constantly creating the person we're going to be in the future. And that person we're going to be in the future also determines whether we're going to be happy, fulfilled, or not. Perhaps very miserable. If we're not careful, we could turn ourselves into somebody who's going to be very miserable. Or we could turn ourselves into somebody who's going to be very positive, open, expansive, happy. And everything we do affects the person we're going to become. And that's the law of karma. And I mean, I suppose in a way it's a scary law. It's a scary idea that everything we do affects the person we're going to become, affects the world we're going to live in the future. Even the smallest action has an effect. Even apparently insignificant little unskillful habits can build up to create quite big volitions, big character traits that are quite difficult to deal with once they've developed. And even apparently insignificant skillful habits, like meditating for a few minutes a day or deciding to tell the truth or deciding to do small generous actions, can build up until they create really positive characteristics in us that lead on to even more positive characteristics until eventually maybe our inner landscape is just completely transformed in a way that we would never have been able to predict from just doing something quite small. So we experience joys and states of mind we may never have imagined we could have, all from quite small things perhaps. So that's the gist, if you like, of the path of self-development. We use the law of karma. We make an effort to set up conditions and practices that gradually change us in a positive way. So often, I mean, we're kept in the same old ruts. Often we're kept in the same old ruts by causes and conditions. And this is symbolized by the wheel So we looked at this symbol in the first part of this series. The idea of a wheel. There's this really artistic wheel. Look, there's a wheel seen from the edge. It's an ellipse. It's a wheel. And we keep going around deepening our ruts in that wheel because we don't make decisions to change our actions. We don't make decisions to change our circumstances. If we make the personal effort to find the sort of chinks in that wheel, the weak points in that wheel, then where we can make some changes, we can use this law of karma and conditionality in a different way. So we make positive changes that lead to more and more positive changes. And this is often symbolized as the spiral path, which, with my incredible artistic talent, I have put sort of diverging from the wheel. So we can choose to go around the wheel, or we can find the chinks in the wheel where we can set up positive, creative conditionality, use the law of karma to develop from one stage to another stage to another stage. And, one frequent way this is sort of framework that's used for this is that the point on the wheel where we can get off, if you like, is dukkha, our experience of dukkha, our experience of unsatisfactoriness, our experience of boredom, anxiety, all those things that happen when we're just left in a room on our own for very long periods of time, or all sorts of things like that. Dukkha, our experience of the sort of fundamental unsatisfactoriness of existence. And we can respond to that in our usual way, which is by trying to distract ourselves from it, etc. And we just keep going around the wheel. Great. Or we can have faith that there's something, that if we face that down, there's something beyond it. So it goes, the traditional way of looking at this goes from dukkha to faith, shraddha, heart knowledge, confidence that there's something beyond. And this is really associated with the practice of ethics. Because we've got shraddha, we practice ethics. And because we practice ethics, we develop happiness and serenity. We become happy, joyful, serene. And then a happy mind becomes a concentrated mind. We can practice meditation. We can have concentration. We can meditate. Because we can meditate, because we're concentrated, we develop vision into the way things really are. Because we start to see things as they really are, eventually liberation follows. So that's a sort of paraphrase of the usual spiral path. So that's an idea about how we use conditionality, use karma, to sort of set up this progressive progress, to develop, okay, under our own steam, in a sense, that we're making the decisions. And this all seems really sane and sensible to me. It's what we teach most of the time. It's what we practice most of the time. Ethics, meditation, sangha, friendship, positive circumstances, study, dharma study, reflection, setting up positive habits, strengthening the positive strands in our being, gradually weakening the negative strands. Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough? Isn't that what the spiritual life is about? Why on earth would we need anything else? Why would we start to talk about this idea of self-surrender and self-realization? Why would we need anything else? It just all seems really sort of pretty obvious. Well, as we said last week, maybe not quite so obvious. Subhuti, when he sort of gave a talk about these things, that was the first time I ever heard of these three paths, said, well, they've each got a downside. And the downsides he came up with for this one were, well, actually, if we succeed really well, we can start to, actually, it can build up our ego rather than making us more, rather than eroding our ego. We start to think, it's a bit like the self-made man or woman, you know. I am a self-made man. I have done it. I meditate for 3 hours a day. I never tell a lie. I am just so wonderful. I course in the dhyanas. And these people can't do that because they're not as strong as me. And actually, what we've done is we've become arrogant. We've become blown up, puffed up. It's the opposite of spiritual development, if you like, which is it's about building up the ego rather than transcending the ego, which we need a bit of, but only up to a certain point. So we can be too successful, and it can just make us egotistical. Or, so we could be too successful, or we could not be successful enough. We could run into things about ourselves that under this sort of self-power, we can't change. We just don't, they just seem to be like, you know, I keep struggling with it, I keep making resolutions about it, I keep doing it, and I just go back to it. And I just can't seem to change it. It just doesn't seem to work. And then we start to get disillusioned, think the path doesn't work. Under our own steam, we just don't seem to be able to do it. And that's the other, perhaps, danger with this model. So those are the two that Subhuti came up with, the two reasons why maybe this model isn't enough, why maybe we need something else as well. And I'm going to look at something else. I'm going to look at that tonight from a slightly different angle. I'm going to put the idea of self-development in what I hope is maybe a bigger context, the context of the hero's quest, okay, or the heroine's quest. No sexism here. So self-development, it's obvious. It's the heroic approach, isn't it? It's the, you know, we do it ourselves. I did it my way. Yeah. We do it ourselves. It's the heroic approach. In contrast, self-surrender, it's a bit wimpy, isn't it? Self-surrender. Ooh, I don't like that. And self-realization, was, you know, sit around and hope that my Buddha nature manifests, you know? I mean, it sounds a bit lazy. So this one surely is the heroic path. And it's quite a common idea to compare the spiritual path to a heroic quest. There's this fellow called Joseph Campbell who wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And what he did is he looked at stories from the mythology and religion, spiritual paths of like loads of cultures all over the world, and sort of compared them. And he came up with a sort of general structure that underlies a lot of them. Which he calls the hero's quest. So according to Campbell, the hero's quest is the attempt to develop ourselves into the beings we could be, the attempt to be the people we could be. And all these myths and stories symbolize this path of development, the path of self-development, and they all follow this sort of common structure. So I'm going to put this idea of self-development into the context of this structure of the hero's quest that Joseph Campbell talks about. And see how much the heroic quest is something that we do ourselves, if you like. Is it about how we develop ourselves, and how much isn't it about how we develop ourselves? And I'm going to use an example from the Buddhist tradition, the story of Xuan Zang, who some people will have heard this elements of this story before, actually, because we talked about him in the refuge tree. So Xuan Zang, he lived in 7th century China, and he made a heroic journey to India to find the true Dharma. He risked his life. He travelled through incredibly inhospitable deserts, over incredibly difficult mountain ranges, forded some of the world's biggest rivers, risked his life on many occasions, overcame some very tempting temptations along the way, and by a series of miracles, apparently, got to China. I mean, he seems to have started out as this rather bookish, scholarly, clumsy, not very good at it world traveller. And somehow managed to make it to India and study with one of the foremost teachers of the day, collect an enormous number of scriptures, return to China. And he grew immensely in the process. He grew enormously in the process. So he started out as this rather scruffy, clumsy, bookish, incompetent vagabond on a worn-out horse. And he returned as a rich, kingly figure who became the teacher of the emperor. And he revitalized Buddhism in China. Had a huge impact that affected the rest of China's history. So that's an example of the heroic quest. And it's a quest by which the central character grows and develops. He or she fulfills his potential. So according to Joseph Campbell, slightly modified by me, the story of the heroic quest, like Tuan Tsang, has these certain sort of clear stages. So the first stage is the core. The hero sort of feels or intuits that he or she has got some sort of destiny or task they should be getting on with. There's something they should be getting on with that's not to do with the sort of regular, everyday stuff they're doing. They may think there's something wrong with the world. They may perceive there's something wrong with the world that needs sorting out. Or they may get signs and hints that they've got some sort of destiny they should be following. They may get sort of things that push them in the direction of that destiny. So this is what Joseph Campbell calls the call to adventure. The call to leave comfort and security and safety and conventionality behind and go and do something that conventional people would think was pretty stupid, actually. And it's usually resisted. We don't want to leave comfort and safety behind, on the whole. Slight detour here into The Lord of the Rings. I won't do the detour into The Lord of the Rings. Too difficult. Just that Frodo's like this in The Lord of the Rings. Frodo's got this definite call. He's got to save the world, Frodo. I mean, he's got to save the world from the Dark Lord. And he often feels this desire to go and follow Bilbo on his adventures. But he stays with the comfort and security, he stays with that. And then he realises the whole fate of Middle Earth depends on him getting rid of this ring of power. So what does he do? He thinks, well, I don't want to miss the summer in the Shire. I think I'll hang around at least until the autumn. So he hangs around, he just can't bring himself to do it, he can't bring himself to go. He hangs around with totally disastrous consequences, almost, until the forces of the Dark Lord have tracked him down and are knocking on his door. That's the point at which he thinks, well, maybe it'd be a good idea to get out here now and make my way to Rivendell. We don't want to do it, it's dangerous. And maybe we feel a bit like that, you know, we want to get really involved in the Dharma. It would be great, but what about my pension? Etc. What about what my dad would say? What about whatever? So the call in the case of Tuan Tsang came in various forms. For a start, he thought that the Dharma that was being taught in China didn't really do it. He thought there was something wrong with it. Maybe it wasn't the whole story. Maybe the translations weren't quite accurate, or maybe they didn't have the sutras that were really going to do it for him. Maybe they weren't available. Whatever. Anyway, he felt a strong urge many times to go to India, the home of the Dharma, and find out what the Dharma really was. And fate seemed to push him towards getting the skills that he was going to need to do this. He just had this really great facility with languages, for example. He could pick up languages really easy, knew Sanskrit. So he had this urge, he was being pushed in that direction, he was being given the equipment to do that to go that direction. He even had dreams telling him to go that way. And, he didn't quite get around to it. It was going to be a bit dangerous, wasn't it? Well, it was going to be very dangerous. In fact, it was an epic. What he was supposed to be doing, it was this incredibly dangerous undertaking. Travelling huge distances through hostile deserts. And he was even, when he mentioned it to the Emperor of China, that he quite liked to go, he was forbidden. It was like, no, you do that and you're an outlaw. So maybe not surprisingly, he sort of backpedaled a little on this. But his destiny called him. It was as though his deeper self from another dimension kept sort of poking him in the ribs and whispering in his ear, saying, why don't you go to India? Why don't you go to India? Go to India! Go to India! I dare you to go to India. And then maybe eventually, if you don't go to India, you're in big trouble from me, sunshine. Depression, all sorts of things. Get yourself to India. So you're going to be a really unhappy mess unless you go to India. So eventually Tuan Sang sort of think, maybe I'll go to India. Maybe I'll go to India and find the true Dharma. So he decides to actually do it. He's going to India. So that's the call. It's a thing that can be refused. The call can be refused. And then the rest of life will be at best safe and boring. And at worst, really miserable. With a feeling of sort of self-hate and regret. But Tuan Sang responds to the call. He leaves comfort and safety behind. He goes off into the wilds. And that's what the next stage is, going off into the wilds. I'm going to call it going forth because it's a more Buddhist phrase. It's taking a decisive step, going into the wilds, metaphorically or real wilds. In the Buddha's day, the Buddha's disciples often went off into the real wilds. They went forth by giving up their identity, giving up their worldly identity, shaving off their hair, wearing sort of ragged robes, ragged old rags, giving away all their possessions and begging for their food and going and living in the forest. It's absolutely radical, sort of like going forth from the conventional life to a really scary life. But it's sort of leaving behind the old self. And it involves sort of passing a point of no return. So in Tuan Sang's case, he decides to go forth, if you like, go forth from what's conventional, what's comfortable, what's safe. And having been forbidden by the King of China from going on this trip to India, he decides to sneak out of China. And he makes his way to the far northwest, to the edge of the Gobi Desert. And on the way, he gets disheartened and stuck for a while. He sort of ends up somewhere thinking, I can't do this. This is really stupid. He nearly turns back. He hasn't burned his boats yet. He can still sort of back out of it. But then he pushes on, and eventually he finds himself at the Jade Gate. He eventually finds himself at the Jade Gate, which is the border of China. It's the end of the civilized world. You can imagine this huge gate. China, civilization on one side, desert, desolation on the other. It's the edge. And once he crosses, once he goes through the Jade Gate, he's gone from one world to the other. He's gone against the emperor's wishes, and he's an outlaw. He's blown it. Well, he's taken the decisive step, if you like. He's taken the decisive step. So he pushes on. He finds himself at the Jade Gate, the edge of the known world, with just a skinny red horse, we're told. It's a really duff old horse that's been palmed off on him by somebody, without a guide, about to set off into the desert. And that's the crucial moment. So passing the Jade Gate is the point of no return, point of complete commitment. Before passing the Jade Gate, he could have second thoughts, go back and be ordinary, if you like, insecure, obscurity. After passing the Jade Gate, there's no turning back. It's do or die. And we're told that he made a vow at that point that he would rather die with his face turned to the west than ever turn back, no matter what happened. So he passes the Jade Gate and he becomes a different person. He goes forth. He's passed a gate into another world or another dimension. It's a dimension where everything is incredibly real and vivid, where deep archetypal forces are at work. So from now on, his life takes on a completely different dimension, dimension of myth. Commitment, his commitment has got magic in it. It brings the universe onto his side, if you like. That's the effect commitment has. So that might look like a wonderful thing that he's done to us. Amazing, yes! Hooray for Tuan Sang, he's gone through the Jade Gate, yes! But that's not what it looked like to Tuan Sang, actually, it has to be said. Down there in the dust of the Gobi Desert on his skinny horse. So to him it probably looked more like he was committing suicide. Here he is, he's a scholarly, bookish, apparently rather clumsy, otherworldly young man with no experience of desert travel, riding a skinny, good-for-nothing red horse, setting off across an infamously lethal desert with no guide. Yes! Nice one, Swanson. And this brings us to the next stage of the quest, the stage of challenges and trial. So sometimes this is like going into the fighting a dragon or something like this, but in Swan Song's case, it starts with fighting the Gobi Desert. Crossing the Gobi Desert is a real challenge, or was then, certainly probably is now. On the whole, people did not cross the Gobi Desert. If they did cross the Gobi Desert, they did it in a caravan with camels and water and guides and lots of support, safety in numbers. Even experienced travellers did not cross the Gobi Desert alone, let alone inexperienced bookish monks on rather skinny red horses. So here is how... Oh, no, I'll get rid of that. So this is how Xuanzang was probably like a completely hopeless thing he was about to do. Wandering off into the Gobi Desert without a guide. But he sets off. And of course, things just then go from bad to worse. Pretty soon, he doesn't know where he is. He's lost. The winds, the desert winds, have blown the sands over any paths, any signs of footsteps or anything. He has no idea where he is. All the tracks have been obliterated. He's got no idea. He keeps going. He keeps going until he realizes that he must have gone way past the first spring, the first oasis that he should have come to. He must be going in the wrong direction. He's missed it. He's missed the oasis. He's missed the spring. He's parched with thirst. So he stops for a sip of his precious water. And how he manages this, I do not know. But it slips out of his hand. His water skin. That's it. He thinks, I'm a dead man. And this, and you are a dead horse. We're goners. We're goners. He's not, you know, he's not that. Experienced desert travellers don't do that. His water bag falls and water gushes into the desert. This is the end. He can't possibly go onwards. And even if he goes back, he probably wouldn't survive. But he turns around and he starts heading back towards the Jade Gate. But then he remembers his commitment. He remembers his oath. Okay, he thinks, I made an oath. I'll die with my face to the west, but I'll not go back on the meaning of my life. This is my call. I'll not go back on it. So he sets off again towards the west. No water. And he struggles onwards with his skinny roan horse for company, the skinny red horse for company. It's all hopeless. There's no water anywhere. He and his horse are parched and dying. He keeps going for days. They get completely exhausted. And then in his desperation, one evening, he says, right, this is it, this is it. But in his desperation, he prays. He prays to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And then he falls asleep. And when he's sleeping, he has a dream. A tall warrior spirit appears to him and says, don't give up. Keep going. Keep going. Don't give up. So as soon as he wakes up, he goes onwards. And after a few miles, his skinny red horse suddenly gets a sort of new lease of life. You know, skittish. And decides to go over there. Wants to go in a completely different direction. And he thinks, let's trust it. Maybe it's Avalokiteshvara. Let's trust Avalokiteshvara and my red horse. I think it's that way. Go on, horse. See where we get to. And his horse sort of... And as soon his horse leads him to a green oasis. He's saved. A green oasis. You can imagine, you know, parched. There's water. There's runnels with the water. There's palm trees. A shining pool of water. He's saved. So he rests there for a day, drinking his fill of water, and fills his water bag and sets off again. And in just two more days, he comes to another oasis, completely by chance. He doesn't know where he's going. He just sort of thought, well, let's head west. Comes to another oasis, completely by chance. And this time, there are people there. And they tell him, well, this is the first of a string of oases. at the foot of the Tan Shan Mountains. Against all the odds, he survived, saved apparently by a skinny horse and Avalokiteshvara. He's passed the first great challenge of his journey, although it's nearly killed him. So that represents the next stage, if you like, the next stage of this of the hero's quest, which is supernatural help. So supernatural help. On his own resources, he couldn't do it. But somehow his determination seems to have summoned up something else. His determination, his faith, his maybe his intuition, maybe that's what the skinny red horse represents, has sort of got him out of trouble. He's put himself in this do or die situation, which he had no hope of getting out of, but whoops, he's got out of it. Supernatural help. And that sort of often appears in this sort of mythic journey. Often it could be all sorts of things. So he's done it. He eventually gets himself across the Gobi Desert, and he arrives at the oasis kingdom of Turfan. And he's welcomed with open arms by the king of Turfan. But the king of Turfan seems to see something very impressive in Xuan Zang now that he's crossed the Gobi Desert. Xuan Zang has passed through all sorts of trials, and he seems to have grown somehow because of what's happened to him. And this is maybe one of the things that being completely dedicated to a heart, something beyond yourself does to people. It makes people grow in stature. It gives presence and weight. So the king is really taken with Xuan Zang. There's something about him that he just really relates to. He feasts him. He gives him the best of everything, and he asks him to stay. He's so impressed, he says, "Become the spiritual leader of my kingdom, O Xuan Zang. Become the spiritual leader of my kingdom. Forget this stuff about going to India. That's going to be tough going. Stay here and you'll be a rich and powerful man." So this, if you like, is the next thing that might happen, which is the temptation. The temptation to settle down. The temptation, having got somewhere with the quest, to settle down. And maybe we all face that temptation at some point in our task. If we're practicing the Dharma, or if we're trying to devote ourselves to some sort of higher cause, then we'll grow. Maybe people notice that. And then all sorts of ways that we could cash in crop up. People think, well, he'd be really good working for my firm in that capacity or other. We get all sorts of jobs offered to us that we couldn't have done before. People take a shine to us who wouldn't have noticed us before. So we could cash it in for a Porsche and a big paycheck. But by this time, Tuan Chang is not going to be tempted by an offer like that. He says, "I am going to the West to find the truth taught by the Buddha, and I'm not going to stop halfway until I've found it." So the king of Turfan is a sort of great tempter. Perhaps he's even tempting Xuan Zang on purpose. But when Xuan Zang resists the temptation, the king changes almost magically into a completely different figure. He transforms into a real king who can give blessing and riches and protection. So perhaps he represents Xuan Zang's inner king, his inner Buddha nature or something, his inner royalty. So the outer king and the inner king come together to bless him. So the king gives him, for his journey, 30 horses, 24 servants, 100 ounces of gold, myriads of silver pieces, 500 rolls of precious material to trade, silks to trade, enough wealth to last him for 20 years and travel wherever he wants. He gives him 24 letters to 24 other kings, asking them to protect Xuan Zang and give him horses, and a vitally important letter to the great Khan of the Western Turks, whose empire covered a huge tract of Central Asia, saying, "He's a good one, look after this man." So we could see this sort of king of Turfan as representing Xuan Zang's own inner royalty, the strength and nobility and inner richness he's uncovered by his commitment and his courage. So now Xuan Zang is blessed and enriched from his own inner being. He's got the resources he needs now, inner and outer, to finish his job. No bother. He's rich, he's protected by kings, he's strong with warriors and servants, both in his inner and in his outer world, if you like. From here on, you just know he's going to make it. So he makes it across the huge mountain ranges, across the terrible rivers, makes it through the bandit country, etc., etc. He's no longer a single scared monk on a skinny red horse. He's a whole royal procession, and nothing's going to stop him. So he makes it to India, where he meets the man who clears up his doubts about the Dharma, the true Dharma. He travels and collects this huge collection of sutras and commentaries, and then he retraces his steps 5,000 miles back over the mountains, back through the desert, and he returns to China, taking his huge collection of scriptures with him. But his return is just very different from his setting out. He left as a sneaking fugitive, this sort of scruffy, sneaking sort of scholarly fugitive on a skinny horse, and he returns at the head of a procession to a hero's welcome. Crowds turned out to greet him. The emperor chooses to forget that he ever forbade him from leaving China, and commissions him to write a book about his travels instead. Later in his old age, the emperor himself becomes a Buddhist and turns to Chuang Tsang as his guide and his teacher. And he left a huge legacy. He revitalized Chinese Buddhism. He's still seen as a towering figure today by Chinese Buddhists, and his influence has spread all over the place, in all sorts of weird ways. So I was actually ordained at somewhere called Chuang Tsang Retreat Center in the middle of India, which was paid for by Taiwanese Buddhists. So I've got a bit of a connection with this guy, I hope, from that. But so his influence just went all over the place. His scene is huge. So Chuang Tsang's was a heroic quest. It was a heroic quest through which he grew enormously. But how much was that a matter of self-development? And how much was it a matter of self-surrender? And how much was it a matter of self-unfolding? So let me... Success! And return. They're the next stages. So he got his goal, but he also returned. He returned to his society, bringing riches, bringing benefits. So that's the hero's quest, according to Joseph Campbell. Which one of those is going on here? That's the sort of quest for self-realization, the quest for, it's the hero's quest to really unfold his inner potential. Is it self-development? Is it self-surrender? Is it self-discovery? So let's just look at a few things about it. For a start, he didn't undertake the quest for self-development. He didn't think, I think I'll travel 10,000 miles over 16 years because it'll sort of develop my character. Nobody in their right mind would do that. Nobody in their right mind would put themselves through what he did to develop themselves. He did it because he felt something important needed to be done. He felt there was something wrong with the world that he needed to put right. He did it for a wider cause. He did it for the cause of the Dharma in India. And he also did it because he, in a sense, felt his destiny or his higher self was pushing him to do it. He did it from a combination of altruistic motives and faith, if you like. What we call it in Buddhism, Shraddha, which is what we put our heart on, what really speaks to our heart knowledge, intuitive knowledge. So he did it from Shraddha. He had this intuitive heart knowledge that this was what he was supposed to be doing. Sometimes I like to think that Shraddha is a bit like the future calling us. It's like saying, this way. This is the right way for you to come. It's like our future self calling us. And his future self called to Chuang Tsang, and he responded. In a sense, he surrendered. He surrendered to his faith in his own future. Powers outside him, for example, in dreams, seem to be telling him, this is what you need to do. Things seem to be pushing him in that direction. So there was a lot of self-surrender in his decision to answer the call. It wasn't a sensible thing to do. It wasn't something that was going to make sense to him, his ego. It was a really nonsensical thing to do. There was a lot of self-surrender in faith, not knowing what was going to happen. And in another sense, you could say that he seemed to be responding to a call from his higher self, self-realization. He could see that what he was doing was all about self-realization. But the self he was realizing had nothing to do with his self-centered, comfort-seeking ego, his conventional self. He didn't do it for reasons that made sense to his ego. His ego, in fact, had to be grabbed, had to be sort of dragged, kicking and screaming through the Jade Gate and into the Gobi Desert. It didn't want to go. So quite a lot of self-realization as well. So maybe what this shows is maybe that the best way to follow the spiritual path is not consciously to do it for self-development. Self-development is all about me, it's all about the self. Whereas the spiritual path and the hero's quest are about going beyond the self. So one really good motivation to follow the spiritual path is to help the world. As long as we're subject to greed, hatred and delusion, we're part of the problem, not part of the solution. A higher cause, to build the Sangha, to spread the Dharma. These are reasons that to follow the spiritual path, which don't have that element of self in them. And another is maybe just to follow our heart knowledge, to follow our faith and see what happens. And whether we do it for a higher cause, like to develop the Dharma, to help spread the Dharma, or because our heart knowledge tells us we will grow, but we don't necessarily make it all about our growth, I suppose. Making it all about my growth has quite a danger in it, I think, which can be like the near enemy of the spiritual path of Buddhism in the West, where we're so individualistic, which is that we get obsessed with me and my mental states and my practice and my meditation. Oh, I couldn't possibly do that. It might disturb my meditation. I might put me in negative mental states. We get very precious. And this is, you know, it's a real danger that some people sort of fall into in practicing the Dharma, is to sort of make it another area of self-obsession. I'll give you a quote about this. The quote comes from a Tibetan teacher called Tsongkhapa, where he's talking about reasons to follow the spiritual life. He says, there is a one-sidedness about practicing to liberate ourselves, which means that we don't benefit ourselves, let alone others. But there is a completeness about practicing for others that means that we benefit others, and accidentally we grow and develop ourselves. And I think that's true. As long as we're focusing on ourselves, it's a bit, well, we're sort of almost self-defeating. So that's the first thing to say, that the call that he followed wasn't a call to self-development. It wasn't a call about me developing myself. It was about something else. It was about, to a large extent, it was about self-surrender and self-realization. Having followed the call, he really committed. So he really committed. There's a lot of self-development in that. And it's, you know, he made a terrific effort. He said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this, do or die. There was an awful lot of self-determination in what he did. But that led him into these apparently impossible trials. Bookish Chuan Sang didn't stand a chance in the Gobi Desert on his own, without a bit of help. He's very brave and he's very determined, but under his own steam he quickly gets into an awful mess. But his do-or-die determination calls up forces that are way beyond Chuan Sang, way beyond his ordinary self, way beyond his little ego. When he makes this complete irreversible decision to follow his heart knowledge, forces come in on his side. He prays to Avalokiteshvara and his skinny horse finds the oasis. Things start to happen that just are beyond, they almost seem miraculous. So he prays to Avalokiteshvara, he's answered with a dream, and then almost by a miracle his horse leads him to water. His horse could be, as I say, his Shraddha. It's a bit skinny because he's a scholar. But he surrenders, doesn't he? He surrenders to it and says, "Yeah, take me, horse. I don't know where this is going. To my ego, to my rational mind, this seems really stupid. Take me, horse. I have faith in you and Avalokiteshvara." And he finds himself at an oasis. So there's a big element of self-surrender in Swan Song Success. When we're really on the hero's quest, when we're following our Shraddha, there are powers that help and support us. And part of what we have to do is have faith in this, to have trust. Our conscious ego will constantly be complaining and worrying. But we need to trust, even surrender ourselves to our heart knowledge, if you like. So what Joseph Campbell, just a quote from Joseph Campbell about this. I mean, he's a scholar. He's a scholar, so he's not a Buddhist. But this is what he says about this. He says, protective power is always present and imminent just behind the features of the world. One has only to know and trust, and the ageless guardians will appear. Having responded to the call and following courageously as the consequences unfold, the hero finds all the forces of the unconscious on his side. Our conscious personality is supported by that larger system to the peril of our other rational ends. So to the peril of our other rational ends. We get what we need, but we don't get what we want, maybe. The ageless guardians maybe aren't going to give us comfort and security and success and money, but they're going to help us with the task. So there's a big element of self-surrender in here, and a big element of self-realization as well. He talks about the forces of the unconscious. Our own self comes on, our own resources come on stream when we really go for something with determination. And a big element of self-surrender. We need to let go, let our ego's rational goals go, let go of the ego's rational goals a bit, trust, have faith, that if we act according to the Dharma, follow our Shraddha, we'll get what we need, if not what we want. So we need to surrender in a way. We need to go for refuge, commit and trust, not knowing what's going to happen. Sangharakshita said somewhere, which I think Vajratara often quotes, that going for refuge is going for refuge to the unknown, because you just don't know what's going to happen. It's not going to be the way we think it is. It's not going to work out the way we want, the way the ego wants. We just have to sort of trust. A lot of self-surrender in it. So the hero's path of self-development, if you like, contains this huge element of self-surrender and this huge element of self-realization. We've got to make that personal effort. Swan Sang was really determined, made a terrific effort. But then we need to trust that something beyond our present personality will respond to that effort. I've heard it said that when we reach up, something reaches down. Unless we pass the jade gate, unless we commit ourselves, fling ourselves into the quest, we can't expect something else to come and help us. We can't expect our depths to respond. And we'll wait a lifetime if we want to just restrict ourselves to surrender and self-unfoldment, self-realization. They only come when we make an effort, when we make an effort on our own side. And they come especially maybe when that effort seems to be completely doomed. So we need to make an effort, commit ourselves, go for refuge. But then we need to trust, surrender, follow our faith. Surrender to the unknown, let our path take us into the unknown, not trying to control things for the sake of our ego's conscious goals. And then maybe the king of our Buddha nature, like the king of Turfan, might bless us, making us rich and royal and protecting us from the dangers. So when we do the first two, maybe we get the third. So that's a little bit about the hero's quest is all about self-development or not, which I hope wasn't too confusing.